Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and I'm joined today by Lee McCormack. Hi Lee.
Hey Christopher.
Lee is a writer and mountain bike coach and an all-round superstar on the bike, and he's here today to talk to me about how to improve your skills. So why don't you tell me about yourself, Lee? How did you get started on the bike?
Well, that's an awesome question, Chris. I'll try to make it succinct, but as a little kid, I was just like every other kid in the world who had to be a Schwinn Stingray, and we all rode, you know, and I loved it. But I also had a weight problem as a kid. I was always heavy, and I was from a Weight Watchers family, the kind of family where you go with your mom to the Weight Watchers meeting, and then you go out to dinner and have a chocolate shake afterward, you know, like, totally mixed messages, you know. So I got away from the bike through my teens and everything. And when I did a little bit of ditch digging, and I did enough of ditch digging to understand that I wanted to go to college. So when I went, I started in journalism, and at the exact same time, I bought my first mountain bike because I'd been doing some motocross and I was in really bad shape. And back then they had 18 gears, dude, 18. And it seemed like you could just ride up any hill with no problem, right? So I spent $300 on this bike, and my parents told me it was a total waste of money and I was never going to ride it, which was probably awesome motivation for a young man. And the thing is, Chris, I just started riding the thing, and I was over 200 pounds at the time, so nothing was easy. But something about riding that bike resonated with me, and I started riding it to school. And the first time I rode to school was 47 minutes, and it about killed me. And I'll never forget how awful I felt physically, but how proud I was of myself mentally and emotionally, right? So basically, I started doing it every day, and it kind of became my religion. I think a lot of cyclists can totally relate to that. And within a year or two, my body started to change. I saw muscles I'd never seen before. And that ride was 12 minutes, from 47 to 12.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I discovered that I had something in there, you know. It was cool because I started getting fit, so I could do other sports. It became a gateway, and I felt more confident. And it was funny because the friends I'd always had kind of liked me being kind of the pudgy, funny kid, right? But not the athlete. But what was funny, Chris, is that the bike opened something up in me, in my soul. And it let me become, I think, who I'm supposed to be. And I'll never forget the day. Like, I just stopped letting them pick on me. You know what I mean? I just didn't feel like being picked on anymore. And that wasn't who I was anymore. And I'll never forget one time they said, you know, man, we like the old Lee better. And I was like, screw that. I'm done with you guys. You know?
Well, I'm glad you didn't go back to the old Lee. I'm not sure you'd be the same person today if you did.
No. And you know how it is. If you're a mountain biker, you can go anywhere in the world and you can ride with people. And we're all part of a tribe here, you know?
Yeah. I should explain a little bit of background, actually. So Lee has coached me several times, and he is an extraordinary talent on a bicycle. And I don't really care whether you're riding a road bike or maybe even like a tri bike, like you're doing time trials. There's something you can learn from this guy. And he's the only person, maybe I've just not seen enough mountain bikers, but he's the only person I've ever seen go uphill on a mountain bike without pedaling, like in a car park, pumping, generating momentum, somehow going up a hill without pedaling. So he's an extraordinary talent. And so what were you like back then? Were you always kind of talented, or did that come with time?
Hell no, dude. You know, like a guy like Curtis Keene, he woke up one day and he got a bike and he was the national champion. Seriously. I'm serious. It was like it took like one season for him to become an expert. And the next season, I'm not kidding, he was the semi-pro national champion, and he was putting in times faster than a lot of the pros. So I'm not that guy. I'm not. I came in, I was heavy. I didn't know what to do. I just liked it. And I started to pay attention to it, you know? It's funny, like now, because, you know, the fitness came on way before the skills did. So there was a time when Brian Lopes and I would ride and I would actually beat him uphill, if you can believe that, you know, it's a long time ago. But I don't know how to say it. Like, the skills were really awkward and it took a long time. And I became a downhill racer and I started to really associate my self-worth with winning races. So, dude, I applied my body and soul to that pursuit, and I hurt myself. I didn't know what the hell I was doing, but I was loving it, right? And at the same time, I was also kind of experiencing success in journalism as an informational graphics guy. And basically, like, I had success there. I won a Pulitzer Prize, which is cool. You know, it's like winning the world championships if you're a downhiller. And I, over the years, I got to the point where I was realizing that I was destined for something a lot more unique, something special. And I quit the newspaper business and went to the dot-com business, which was insane. And I was making lots of money. And I don't know if you've ever seen the movie Whale Rider.
I haven't actually.
It's a good one, dude. It's about fate. And it's it won every award independent film can win. And it's about this Maori tribe and a girl. It's her destiny to become the king of the tribe. So it's a really hard story for her. And as we're watching her life play out, I'm in the Palo Alto theater with a bunch of 25-year-old millionaires, right, during the dot-com deal. And something hit me, dude. Like, I really felt, and I'm not a religious guy, but I really felt like God was tapping me on the shoulder going, dude, are you following your fate? Are you honoring your purpose? And I was like, nope. And I started to cry. And by the end of that movie, Chris, I was bawling openly. I couldn't control it. I went to work the next day and I quit, period. I quit. Wow. And I do not recommend this from a money management standpoint, because I had a six-figure salary that went to zero. And I left 3 weeks before the stock options were coming in. So maybe I could have waited 3 weeks, right? But that was it, dude. I realized that, like, I had this vision that I was going to use my passion for bike riding and my professional skills. By then, I've been trained to, like, research any topic on earth, write about it, illustrate it, express it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I'd done it with 1,000 topics in the newspaper business, with designing software. And I felt like, okay, it's time for me to bring my two branches in together. And I had this vision that I was going to write the definitive mountain bike skills book. I was going to do it in a way that had never been done before. So I started, you know?
I was going to say, we've got a really powerful combination of things coming together here. So, you know, with Curtis Keene, I would question, it might be that he's a really good coach, but I find that the people that have had to work really hard for it, the best coaches, just because it didn't come to them naturally, right? You had to work really hard at the skills. And so that process that you went through of learning, you're really familiar with it, and you can perhaps communicate it to someone else. Perhaps if you're a good communicator, which you also happen to be, obviously an amazing writer, and the diagrams in the book are extraordinary, which is what originally drew me to it. And so now we've got something, a really amazing package coming together now.
Yeah, thanks, man. Looking back, I think this is just my purpose and my fate. You know what I mean? And Curtis, who I know well, and he teaches with me, he happens to be a pretty good teacher. Uh-huh. And he's a good guy. And I think that's a huge part of being a good teacher. But like you said, like when I quit the job, I opened up a Word document and I'm like, you know, like the blinking cursor of death. It's like, okay, I've been riding. And at that time, I've been winning national downhills in Cat 1. I think I was like the age group national champion. I got to go to Worlds and I was top 10. I was riding pretty well, you know, but that was the first time I ever sat down and tried to codify, like, how do you ride a bicycle? Like, what are the dynamics? Like, how can you express to somebody? Because I've been trained, dude. I've done thousands of infographics in my career and hundreds of articles on any subject in the world. So it's like you go in and you're like, okay, assume someone knows nothing. How do you teach them? Remember, you know, it was an incredibly challenging process. And that was the first time I actually really analyzed what goes into riding a bike. And what's funny is that's when I personally began to master the craft, really, for real. That's when I started. And so that first book was 10 years ago. And now I'm just leaps and bounds beyond that as a teacher and as a rider, both.
Are there some things you can look at? So I know, you know, I found an old picture of myself on a mountain bike recently, and it would appear at that time I thought going fast on a mountain bike was all about making everything as light as possible. So there's various parts on this bike that I'm sat on that have probably come from a road bike. It's kind of funny, but, you know, I just was all about the fitness and thought that nothing else was important. And now I realize that's maybe only half the equation. So is there something that you look at? So when you see someone riding, can you tell that they're a really good rider just from some certain visual cues?
Yeah, it's funny. I can see someone on a bike for like 100 meters, and I can pretty much tell where they are. And the cues that I see relate to my teaching method. So number one, are they balanced on the bike? And I'm going to guess that back in the day, you weren't. You were either too far forward or if you're afraid, you're too far back. Is the rider low enough to create range of motion? And most people are too high. They're too high and too far back because they want their brain to be away from the perceived danger, right? So it's like you can tell, like a Lopes, no matter what crazy situation is going on, right? Drifting sideways on the kamikaze, shredding like a trail near his house. He's in the middle of his bike and he's pretty low, you know? And then that allows him to operate. And another thing too is that there's a decisiveness of movement that you can see in a skilled athlete. And it's funny because it doesn't matter, like Chris, whether you're going off a curb or hucking like a Red Bull drop, you know, it doesn't matter. It's just like whatever we do in our lives and on the bike, I feel like we should do it. It should be decisive, right? Mm-hmm. So I can tell just like the way a person gets on his or her bike, the way they turn the pedals, the way they are in the bike, whether they're at home, they're balanced, whether they've created range of motion for themselves, and whether they're decisive. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And are you decisive all the time when you ride your bike? Because I find that I have moments where I'm thinking about the things that you've taught me, and I am decisive, and I'm feeling energetic, and I'm excited. This ties in with the conditions quite often. So
right. We've
just had a little bit of rain in Northern California, and they call it hero dirt, right? And suddenly yeah. I'm like really excited, and I find myself making all kinds of sine waves that I would normally. Do you ride like that all the time? Like every time you go out, is that important?
I really try to, yeah. I'm not perfect. And this is the thing, Chris, like I'm getting all emotional. So I don't care how fast you go. I don't care how big you go. I don't care whether you go over the rock, around the rock, or use that rock to double another rock. I don't care. You know what I mean? What I care is, do you understand the situation? Do you, number one, do you want to do the thing, whatever it is, climbing a hill, going down a drop, whatever it is. Do you want to do it? If you want to do it, awesome. Do you know how to, right? Do you know what to do? Exactly. And my method's all about teaching you the specific movement patterns that lets you shred. Once you want to do it, can you visualize it? And then can you do it right now? And if all those answers are yes, then I say freaking do it. Mm-hmm. There's no guessing. There's no halfway. You just do it. And so, like, for example, I have really, really unhealthy shoulders. Really, they're really bad right now. And so if I'm warmed up and I feel good and we're out on trail and there's like a, say, a 6 or 8 foot drop into kind of a rocky section, if I feel good, I know what to do. I'll do it. Right. It's decisive. Mm-hmm. If I don't feel it, and there are a lot of days when I don't trust my shoulder, I just will not do it. I won't do it. Does that make sense?
Okay.
And yeah, and then and so then there's a decisiveness in my decision not to do it. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
But the whole thing where you pray and go for it anyway, that's insanity. You're going to get hurt. You're teaching yourself how to be afraid. You're creating negative associations and improper skills. Does that make sense? So I hope that makes sense. Like, I believe that we should be decisive. If you feel like crap, ride the trainer in your office.
Right.
If you feel good, go out and shred it. Right.
Yeah, I understand. That's an interesting thought. And so all these different traits that you see in someone that's really good at riding their bike, can you break it down at all? Is it to do with strength, or is it mostly skill, or is mobility, or all of these things equally important?
I think they all fit together. And a lot of it depends on your goal. Like, I think the healthiest goal on earth for any rider, I'm talking about people who don't make a living, right? Like Cam Zink has a whole different risk ratio than we do, right? I mean, the big thing is, imagine a chart where skill, where challenge is vertical and skill is horizontal. Like the sweet spot where those meet is fun. So I think that for most people, even if you're a racer, like you want to always kind of grow and stay in that sweet spot, that fun area, the flow area.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's interesting is it doesn't matter if you're skinny or fat. Like, you happen to be a really good climber. That's how you're made. And that's awesome. Good for you. That's great. I'm not. That's not how I'm made. I'm a sprinter. So, but it doesn't matter what body you have. It doesn't even matter ultimately, Chris, how brave you are, how afraid you are, how injured you are. Like, and my thought is, let's teach you the tools for you to reach the next level. And the way I teach is completely scalable. So whatever I teach you on the first day, when you're a Cat 3 beginner, is the same skill you're going to use when you're on a World Cup. It's just, we're going to use it with more power. Mm-hmm. Hope that makes sense. And so I believe that anybody who wants to ride a bicycle can do it, and they can have a long and really satisfying career on the bicycle. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you want to go and be a top pro, all right, like Curtis, for example, is just freakishly strong. You know,
yes, I see. His legs are ridiculous. His calves are bigger than my thighs by quite some considerable.
I know, and he's skinny right now for enduro racing. But I've known him a long time, and that guy is fundamentally a brute. He's just strong.
Yeah,
you know, like I think his dad's Frankenstein and his mom's Wonder Woman. You know, I don't know, but that he has that going for him. And then, and I think what's interesting too is like the way I see it, skill is your ability to make your body and bike do what you want them to do.
Mm-hmm.
Fitness is your ability to make your bike and body do it longer, faster, harder, bigger. Is that fair? Mm-hmm.
It is.
And confidence is your ability to execute whatever it is you have in that moment. And so those are the three legs of the stool. And I think they're all completely related to each other. And it's fascinating because if you're Curtis, I love that guy. I used to train and travel together all the time. He's handsome. He's a freaking stud.
You sound like you got a bit of a crush on him.
Well, yeah, we used to travel, but he's an admirable guy because on top of everything else, he's just a nice guy.
Yeah.
And I've been in situations where I've needed his help and he's literally saved my life. There's a whole story about him plucking me and my dog out of a river one day. He's a good guy. But it's interesting, like you grow up being that guy where you succeed at every sport and girls think you're hot. Like your confidence comes in at a higher level. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Than maybe if you came in as like a brainy fat kid.
Right.
And so I think that's one reason that Curtis is able to come in and just access his full athletic ability, bam, right away. Where for me, as an example, I have a lot of confidence in my intellectual ability, right? So that's how I came through the bike. And then through dedicated practice over the years, now I like to think I'm a pretty decent bike rider.
Oh, yeah. I would confirm that most wholeheartedly.
Well, thanks, man.
Which of these traits are trainable? So which are things I'm just stuck with? Like if I'm always going to be a kind of skinny, slow twitch guy, and which are the things that I can actually train? So should I be training to my weaknesses or strengths or both? Or how does that work?
I love it. Well, I don't look at you as a weakness. I'm like, I wish I was a skinny, good climber. That'd be awesome because your power to weight ratio is like the bread and butter of a mountain biker, right?
Right.
So that's genetic. I mean, we know that it's genetic. So if you have it, you can develop it and you should develop it. That's awesome. My trainer, a guy named Lester Pardo, he was an Olympic level speed skater and he's an elite trainer here in Boulder. He always told me that I should train my weaknesses and raise my strengths. So when he tested me, I'm a decent sprinter. I was okay. But I was terrible at endurance. So he kind of gave me the tools to improve my endurance. So I'll never be elite ever, but I'm better. And you know what's funny too, Chris, is the process of training my endurance. And by the way, I also really studied how to pedal. So learning how to pedal better, my endurance is better, but so is my sprint. Like compared to about 3 years ago, all of my numbers are more than 50% higher, all of them.
That's crazy. I think I saw some of your numbers the other day. What's your 5 minute power now?
I don't have a number for five.
Already.
What about two? I have a 3 minute. Let me pull it up real fast. Okay. I'm on the internet right now.
So I did a workout the other day and I was really disappointed that I could only get 425 watts for 2 minutes. I nearly puked.
Well, that's pretty good, I think. And also, you know, this time of year, if you've been riding and racing, you're tired. So the last time I tested, this was about a month ago. This is the end of the season, so my numbers are down.
Uh-huh.
My 3 minute power, so my 20 minute power is about 300 watts. It was 290 the other day.
Yeah.
Which is pretty average at my body weight. It's very average. My 3 minutes is 400 watts. But my sprint power the other day was 1,774 watts.
So there's the difference right there. It's like
that's how I made.
So I did a sprint workout yesterday I've been doing cycle cross and it looks like a time trial on paper, but actually it's a series of short sprints because there's so many freaking corners.
Yeah.
And I can hit 1,000 watts just about, but that's it. So
that's really good though, because I know that your threshold power is probably really good.
Yeah, it's not bad. In the past, it's been at well over 300, but yeah, right now, not so much. But
300 at your body weight is good. So mm-hmm. like I think that like your inherent like your aerobic capacity, I think we're born with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is what it is. So we can optimize it. But you should always work on your sprint power, mm-hmm. and I should always focus on my endurance.
So train to your weaknesses. So then what can I do for strength and stability and mobility? What kind of exercises do you like for that?
I do a mix, and I studied it a bit in college, but I like to use the best of everybody. So I work with a guy named D. Tidwell here in Colorado, and his business is Enduro NTB Training. And what I do every day is a mix of stability, mobility, and strength work every single day. I just did it before I called you. Mm-hmm. And it takes me about 25 minutes. And then it's funny because I did 15 minutes of sprinting while doing figure eights in my driveway. That was my workout today. So I get skill and strength, everything. But and I'm 45 now. And so I'm at the age where the body's starting to change, brother. And I think it's super important for us as riders, everybody, younger the better, to get heavy duty hardcore on your stability work. I think it's super important. And I think we need to all learn how to stabilize our spine from the inside out and get strong in the ways that count.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, back injury can be devastating and completely end your life, let alone your career on the bike, racing or anything like that.
Totally. Like at this time last year, I was miserable, man. I was barely making it. And it turned out that just from all the years of abuse to my body, some of the stabilizer muscles stopped working. They just were not there. So it was funny. I could go coach downhill all day. I could lift weights. I could dig a hole, build a pump track as long as I was paying attention. But at the end of the day, I would just reach for toilet paper and my back would go out. Bam, done. So D has helped me understand the really deep muscles that we've never heard of and learn to fire them. And so I'm proud to say I've not had a back blowout all year, which is awesome. And you know, it's funny, like that last sprint workout I did, the only difference is I've been doing more core work this year and I just found another 30% in my sprint power, 30%.
Wow. So it's not about the legs. It's about you can stabilize your core in order to deliver that power.
Exactly. For me. Yeah. And I think for most of us, it's like, where are your shoulders floating around? You got to stabilize them. And what are your hips and spine doing? Mm. And more, I understand how important this is. And I understand because I've personally have worked hands-on with something like 4,000 riders over the years. And I'm talking about everybody from someone who's never ridden a bike before to like top pros who we've all heard of. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'm telling you right now, if you're not stable and mobile in the ways that matter, you can't ride a bike well. You just can't do it.
And I think this is even true for, say, a triathlete that's riding a time trial style bike. If they don't have a stable core, like I've heard the commentators talk about this on the TV the other day, I was watching the Tour of Britain, and they were talking about how, you know, this habit that riders do where they just rest their forearms on the bars and they're not holding onto anything. So it's like they're holding onto an imaginary aero bar.
Right.
It's quite aerodynamically efficient. But it's very difficult to stabilize your core in that position because you're not holding on to anything anymore.
I agree. So this is the thing. I would like to look at them closely, right? And so if you can tell, like basically, if someone's on their road bike, right, or on their mountain bike, and their triceps are flexed, that means there's weight on the handlebars, right? And if there's weight on the handlebars, that's a sign that their core is not stable and their core is not stabilizing them. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
Now, if you have a traditional cross country fit where you're in your drops on your road bike or even the tops, it takes a lot of core strength, a lot to keep your hands weightless, you know,
right.
A lot. And so back to the idea of decisiveness, like I can't maintain that position for 2 hours on a road bike. I can't. But so when I'm on my road bike, I'm on a trainer or on my hill where I live doing intervals. And while I'm doing the intervals, I'm absolutely focusing on perfect core, perfect. Mm-hmm. And you know what's funny, Chris? It's like if your legs are tired, but your core is okay, all you are is slow. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if your core blows out or your core is unstable, you're miserable. You got nothing, you know?
Yeah, it definitely holds you back. So talk to me about the mechanics of the bike, like range of motion and that type of stuff. Do you find people that just cannot get into the positions that you need them to be in order to be as skillful as they could?
Yeah, I see it all the time. And one issue is bike setup. And I'm not going to use the word fit, because the word fit apparently is a very loaded word.
Right.
So I'm going to say, because the fitters of the world are kind of uniting against me right now, I like to think about cockpit optimization, we'll call it. And, you know, and this is the thing, like, if you have an issue with your knees or your hips when it comes to pedaling, go see any qualified fitter, and wherever they tell you to put your seat, dude, listen to them. Like, period. I have nothing to say about that. But get a dropper seat post so you can drop it when you downhill. And then my thing, and if you take a class with me, we'll do this. I like to put the bars someplace where you can actually manage your bicycle, where you have range of motion, where the various force lines, the vectors, line up correctly. And so in general, that means a shorter stem most of the time. Like 90% of riders prescribe a shorter stem. And so by bringing the bars closer to you, you have a fighting chance. Mm-hmm. And then the big thing is, can you stand on your feet, keep your knees on top of your feet, and hinge your butt back and get your torso level? They call it a hip hinge.
Right.
And a lot of people can't. And a lot of dudes just cannot do it. And I'm here to tell you that the only way to simultaneously be balanced at the middle of your bike, which is the only place to be, and create range of motion from your shoulders, is to push your butt way the hell back and bring your face forward. And if you don't have that mobility in your hamstrings and that core strength, you can't ride well. You just can't.
Right. And this is really easy to test as well. You can put your toes up against the wall and then just see if you can lower your body weight. And if you can't do it, then yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, there's a million tests. And so I just, like last year, I published a program on my site called F6. Mm-hmm. Six moves to build your foundation. And it's focused on that stuff. Mm-hmm. It takes 10 minutes. You can do it anywhere. But I see it all the time. And a guy like Curtis has that mobility. And you know, Chris, you and I have worked together where I try to get you to lean your bike as much as possible, mm-hmm. you know, in turns. So Curtis and I were out teaching a group of coaches for NorCal High School League. And I call it the death spiral, where you start with a wide radius turn and you just get tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter. And you see how far you can lean your bike, right? And for me, I'll lean the bike until like my back tire is hitting my butt, you know, it's pretty low. And so that day I'm like, hey, Curtis, let's see what you have. Let's see what you can do. So he's on flat pedals and he went around and around and around and around. And he went all the way till his handlebar was on the ground.
Yeah, extraordinary.
Yeah, and he was still on his pedal somehow. And I'm like, that's the kind of strength that a World Cup dude has, mm-hmm. you know?
So we should probably explain here, he's not doing like some kind of, do you know, like one of those motorcycle things, the wheel of death where they ride around, but they're still like at 90 degrees, completely perpendicular to the ground. So he's leaning his bike way more than his body, right? So his body's still pretty upright, but the bike is cranked right over it. And that's how you're cornering all the time, right?
Yeah, exactly. And in that situation, his body's almost straight up and his bike is literally touching the ground. Uh-huh. But most of the time, it's safest for us, I believe, to lead with the bike angle. And if you ski, you understand that the more you lean a ski, the tighter the turn is. Mm-hmm. The same thing. It's the same exact geometry on a bicycle. So like the actual cornering forces come from leaning your bike. Mm-hmm. And again, my logic is, okay, you got to be in the middle of your bike with your hands weightless. From there, get low and lean your bike. And if you can do that, then you can corner.
And then talk to me about trail flow. This is something I'm still like grappling with to an extent. So it seems like you're looking ahead on a trail and visualizing things and making decisions ahead of time that most people probably are not. How does that work?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. And that's something that I've been paying a lot of attention to this year for myself. I think it comes down to like the whole system, right? You have the bike, you have your fitness, your skills, and your confidence. Okay. And then, as you know, when you're a beginner or you're afraid, you're going to look pretty close. You're not going to look very far ahead and you end up in a reactive position. So we'd like to build all the legs of the stool. And we, as much as we can, we want to look as far forward as we can. And what I think happens is whatever your body, I think the brain is pretty dang amazing. I really do. And I think it's always monitoring everything that's between it and the ground, if that makes any sense.
It does.
So it's checking your spine, your hips. It's checking my shoulders. It's checking your suspension, your tires, everything. And the quality of the dirt, like everything. And I believe that once you get to a certain level of competency, that you know what you can do. You know what you're capable of. Does that make sense? You understand. And so, by the way, if you look at an option, like say a jump from rock to rock, and your stomach gets tight or you feel afraid, then you're not ready. Don't do it. Period. That's it. Right? Like, listen to your body. But if you're nervous and you want to go for it, do it. So my advice to everybody is look as far forward as you can and look for shapes that fit your current riding level. I hope that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So for example, if I am on my rigid hardtail and my shoulders hurt, right? And I'm going along and there's a bunch of rocks, I might not want to hit them. And I might not feel like jumping. So I might just go ahead and corner around them. I can corner pretty well. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
If I'm on my camber, which is a 4-inch travel 29 trail bike, I might kind of pump right straight through the rocks. If I'm on my Enduro, which is a 29er, completely amazing bike, and this happens all the time, I will come into that section faster because the bike's more capable. And my brain will make the connection of like, oh, I can hit the first rock and jump to the last rock, and I'll jump the whole section. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
And so what's cool is, like, each of those lines is a totally awesome, fun, viable line. It's just like, in the moment, what am I choosing to do? Like, what is the system capable of in that moment? And I think that it's important and awesome for people to get in touch with that for themselves. Mm-hmm.
So is that still a conscious decision for you? Does that just happen without you thinking about it now? Or
more and more it happens without me thinking about it. And I've had the luxury I've spent a lot of time working on the absolute basics, the absolute fundamentals, and thinking about them and teaching them. I teach it every day. So on that rare occasion when I get to ride for myself, right? Number one, I don't race anymore, which is actually very freeing. It's awesome because there's no pressure. Number two, I don't have to prove anything to anybody. Like, I'm just some guy. Mm-hmm. No one cares how fast I am, right? It doesn't matter. So I'm able to come into this in an organic way. And I'm noticing my body doing incredible things, mm-hmm. absolutely incredible things, if I can let it go. It's absolutely phenomenal and so fun. And that's kind of when you know you're into the state of flow with a capital F, the magic.
Mm-hmm. I think an important part of this trail flow thing, the thing that's making it working is, I mentioned earlier that you're able to propel the bicycle without pedaling in this thing that we call pumping. And I think the easiest way to describe it that everybody will understand is if you've ever ridden a skateboard in kind of any sort of half pipe. So you can take basically anyone and have them roll backwards and forwards in a smooth half pipe. And eventually they'll start to pump and start to gain momentum. And you're doing the same thing on the bicycle. And then that's fitting into the trail flow. So you're using those opportunities in the trail to gain momentum without pedaling. So how does that, how do you do that? How do I get started with that on the bike?
You're getting me so excited. Yeah, that's the magic, right? And so in the beginning, and I started riding a mountain bike in 1988, things were kind of different then, you know? In the beginning, every bump is an obstacle, right? And you're just trying to avoid them or just manage them. Mm-hmm. And you're just hitting things and waiting for bad things to happen to you. Like, ultimately, I want everybody, I always talk about the sine wave of love, right? I want everybody to look at any terrain they ride. It could be a road, it could be a cross-country trail, a pump track, dirt jumps, a DH track, whatever you ride, I don't care, a cyclocross track. I want you to perceive the wave. Like, there is a sine wave there. Now, it might be like gross looking, it might be a pile of rocks or something. Mm-hmm. But like, at whatever level you're at today, I want you to perceive that every turn is a wave that happens to be sideways. And any kind of undulation or bump is a vertical wave. And so in the beginning, it might just be kind of smooth things that you see as waves, like a smooth roller, like on a pump track. So what I say is like understand and practice pumping a smooth roller, like in an isolated situation, like a pump track's the best place ever, right? Mm-hmm. And then once that neuromuscular connection, once that habit is formed, there comes a day when you're on trail and you're coming to a water bar that used to buck you over the handlebars, and all of a sudden you pump it like you have it. You know what I mean? And so I'm a big fan. It's like Karate Kid, like practice the skills in isolation as much as you can. Mm-hmm. So you really get them dialed in and then let your brain apply them on trail. And what happens is as you get better at making big angles with your bike and as you become more powerful, essentially like I weigh 180 pounds. I can make my bike weigh 800 pounds if I wanted to, and I can make it weigh zero, right? So like as you get more powerful, you allow yourself to get way heavier and way lighter. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so your wave, your amplitude of the wave, the height of the wave gets higher. Okay. Right around then, like a big pile of rocks, you start to perceive it as one shape. So you're going to bunny hop or pump the whole pile. And what happens then is your speed starts to increase. So not only is your wave, your amplitude high, bigger, it's taller, but your wavelength is longer. Does that make sense?
It does.
And so what happens, and I believe that we should all stay within our comfort zone, is you start to naturally look farther forward. You start to look for these shapes and you start to ride the sine wave of love. That's what I call it. So basically it's like mogul skiing where you're in phase with the terrain. And as long as you're in phase with the terrain, the speed feels easy. It feels comfortable. It's flowy. And that's the sweet spot. I don't care how fast you're going. But the fact is, if you do this, you will go fast. Speed will come.
Right.
And then as you get stronger, as you get more balanced, as your bikes get better, you start to make bigger waves. And then like I teach like a skills tree approach. So we teach you how to corner. We teach you how to handle bumps separately. There comes a time when you're pretty damn good at cornering and doing bumps and your brain is amazing at combining skills. That's how you learn music and math. And so you'll get to the point where say there's a tight corner and a pile of rocks after that, and then another tight corner. You get to the point where you drill that corner and you pump that corner and accelerate. You're really heavy in the corner and you use the lightness out of the corner to hop over the rocks, and you land on the back of the last rock and get more pump, and you're heavy in the next corner. I hope you can visualize that. So it's always a wave, and ultimately you're always turning and you're always doing bumps all simultaneously.
And then how do I get started with this? How do I get started with pumping? Is it possible to read one of your books and start to understand how to do this? And what should I then start on the tarmac or find a pump track or which is best?
The books seem to work. A lot of people get a lot out of the books for sure. So the books are the cheapest way. My favorite way is if you take a class with me or one of my coaches, of course, right? And if you have access to a pump track, that's fantastic. Because that's ideal because it's repeatable. It's a literal wave. A BMX track is cool. If you have anywhere in your area where there's just like some rollers that are kind of consecutive, you can use them. And by the way, like if there's any land in your area, sometimes it's hard to get permission to build stuff. But if like a bunch of rollers happen to appear overnight, you know, magically, you could use them for training. So that's ideal. But you know what? It's interesting is once you've kind of, and I teach this all the time, like once I teach you the basics of cornering on just on flat ground, I can then teach you how to pump turns. Mm-hmm. And if we're like, if I'm doing a class where all we have is a parking lot, say, or flat terrain, I'll teach you how to pump turns. And so what's cool about pumping corners is you're combining a lot of vectors. Like you're staying balanced in the middle of the bike, you're leaning the bike, you're rotating your body, and you're loading the ground. Mm-hmm. So once you can pump flat ground, like in a parking lot, that's a really high degree of bike control. And that for more and more of my clients, that's the drill I teach them. Cause that way you can essentially transcend the pump track and you can pump anywhere you are. Mm-hmm. Period.
So that's great. There's two things there. In fact, there's lots of things here you've talked about, which you don't need a whole bunch of fancy equipment or trails to do. So
nope.
And then the same is true of the strength training, right? You don't need an amazing, you know, world-class gym and all that kind of stuff. There's stuff that you can do in 10 minutes in your home, which is, I think, really cool.
I think that's the way to go, especially if you have kids. Which we both have.
Like, who has time to go to the gym? It sucks.
And if you're a cyclist, why would you ever drive somewhere to work out? Like, that's just not who we are. That's madness. So So I keep my exercise bands and my dumbbell and my stability board and a yoga mat in my van. Mm-hmm. I have a Sprinter van that I teach out of. And so every day before I teach, I do my workout. Mm-hmm. Done. And it's perfect. It doesn't take – it's funny. Like trail riding is the best. That's my favorite. But I look at that as the place where you execute all your skills. If you are busy, a real human being, and you want to get good at bike riding, you can get damn good at it in front of your house in a driveway. I'm serious. You can learn a lot.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And you can learn a lot.
Yeah, it's funny. It's like you watch little kids and that's exactly what they do. And it's kind of, you know, I've just got a new kid. She's only one. And it's really interesting to see her move perfectly. And it's really interesting to see the kids playing on their bikes in the street. You know, that's how you got good in the first place. Not spending 3 hours driving to some trails or something.
I know, right? And you turn on Strava and you chase your buddy. And, and all you really get better at is whatever you know. And please forgive me, Chris, but most people are pretty terrible. Mm-hmm. They don't know what to do. Why? How would they know? And they're pretty awful. And the more you ride, the more awful you get. Mm-hmm. That's why, like, the hardest clients are the guys who've been riding for 20, 30 years and who think they're amazing.
Yeah.
It's tough to untangle those habits. Really tough.
And then, so what happened in between? So Mastering Mountain Bike Skills is an incredible book, extraordinary visual aid. I'm not sure many other people on the planet could have created that. And then you created a second revision that was, I think, significantly better. And so what happened in between those? At what point did you realize that you could do better and create that second revision?
One thing that happened was Mastering Mountain Bike Skills was that publisher's best-selling trade book, period. So they drove the second edition. They wanted to do it. And honestly, I wasn't that excited about it because the financial arrangement with that publisher isn't so great. Like if you buy a book from Barnes & Noble, I get like 50 cents, you know?
Yeah.
So all my current books, I published myself. But what changed a lot is when I did the first book, I was a racer. I was a racer and I was a journalist. And I partnered with Brian Lopes, who, of course, knows something about bike riding. And I interviewed Steve Peed and Mark Weir and all these awesome people, right? And so I kind of did it as a racer, but mostly as a journalist, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. I researched it. I used to do infographics about stem cells on Deadline. You know, it's the same idea. You research it, you figure it out, and you express it. So it was that, but fueled by my personal passion, right?
Right.
When the second edition was done, it was about 5 years later. And what was different was I had been coaching for 5 years. Like when I did the first book, Chris, I never, ever thought I was going to be a bike coach. I had no interest at all.
Oh, wow.
And I had no concept of that at all. It was never a thought. But when the book came out, I started thinking, you know, real sports have curricula. Like skiing has a curriculum. When you take your kid to swim lessons, there's a curriculum. They know how to teach kids how to play soccer. And I was like, darn it, this is a real sport. It's time for someone to make a curriculum. So I gave myself the assignment, right, to teach, create this thing. By so doing, I started to teach it, to test it out, you know? Mm-hmm. And what happened was I realized that I think I'm a born teacher. I mean, it just resonated with me. And when you're a journalist in newspapers, you have words and pictures. Now I have words. I have my gestures, I have my body, my soul, my heart, my mind, my whole everything to convey information to people. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. I never picked up on that originally because I never knew you as a journalist or a designer. The first time I met you was for a skills clinic, right?
And so you knew me as a coach, right?
Yeah, I knew you as a coach and I'd already had the book for quite a long time, I think. And so, you know, it just never even really occurred to me that you might have changed in some way over that time.
Yeah, that was my background. So bottom line, like when I did the second book, I had been teaching that stuff for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I was getting to a point where I was committing to doing that for my livelihood too. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very different book. It's a lot more effective when it comes to teaching and learning. It's a lot simpler. And it's funny because when I wrote the first book, I was still like trying to win national downhills. So I talked about like, if you're scared, just fist the brakes. Just, you know, I mean, don't touch the brakes. Just fist the grips. You know, I took that out of the second edition. Now my philosophy is like, if you think you're going too fast, slow down. You know, but that's like the 45-year-old dad of four and coach talking now, right? Like, but yeah, it's different. And now, like compared to that book, it's been another 5 years, and I've taught so many people. it's really accelerated. So the stuff I teach now is way more elegant, way more scalable, way more dialed in. Just it's a whole new thing.
That's super cool. And then how did that develop into the strength and fitness programs?
I came in, like, I have a background in exercise physiology, but there are a lot of other guys doing that work and I respect them. So I stayed away from it. But like I said, like, I've worked with so many people. Like, number one, for the mobility, that's that F6 program. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just like, if you can't move well on off the bike, you can't move well on the bike. And I realized, like, I want something that people can use that specifically helps them ride a bike better. And it also happens to be better, like, on moving day and airport day. And mm-hmm. and my opinion is those are the two tests of real fitness is when you're moving and when you're at the airport with all your kids' stuff. Like, how strong are you, you know? So I just did that to kind of, I wanted it to be simple. I wanted it to be something you could do at home. I wanted it to be founded on really sound exercise science. That's why I partnered with Aaron Carson here at Rally Sport in Boulder. And I wanted it to be something that people could do. So 10 minutes, most people can do, right? So that's that. And then there's the two fitness programs. And I mean, there's a lot of fitness training out there, Training Peaks. There's lots and lots of great coaches out there. But I wanted something that was simple, something that was bone effective, just absolutely will not beat you up and will give you maximum benefit. And I also wanted, for the first time, to really bring an understanding of a pedaling skill and what it means to be a mountain biker. Like, we don't just sit down and pedal at 100 RPM. We do other things. Mm-hmm. So that first program, Pump Up the Base, is designed to build. I do it, and it's made a huge difference for me. It builds your aerobic capacity and your sprint power. So both ends of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And while you're doing it, you're building technique. It's been massively beneficial for me and for the people I know who use it. And then the other program, Prepare to Pin It, is a more intense program that you'd use during the season. But I just, the reason I did them was because I realized that there was a need for them, you know?
Right.
And I wanted to come in as a guy who's busy. I've got multiple jobs, kids, I'm a grown up, and who wants to be able to ride effectively, you know, and who wants to, like, only subject myself to enough punishment to get the adaptation and ride better.
So it's a minimalist program, right?
Yeah, it's pretty efficient. It's pretty effective. And if you can just do these things, you see massive benefit, massive.
Right. Yeah, I'm starting to realize this, you know, as I get older and I do more research, that, you know, you think you're doing the right thing by doing these super long workouts. I must be so in such good shape because I ride my bike for 4 hours at the weekend. But
right.
When you look more carefully at the research, you see that especially the changes that happen to heart muscle is it grows thicker. Is actually a pathology, and it's the heart pump actually stops working so well. And
right. Like, they see that in marathon runners.
Yeah, exactly. They all start dropping dead of heart attacks and it's nothing to do with atherosclerosis. It's kind of, it's quite scary.
It is nutty. And so I the Boulder Center for Sports Medicine is right here in town. So I work with those guys. So I partnered with Lester Pardo, my trainer, to do these programs. And it's the same protocol as I use there, pretty much, but with a real focus on a busy mountain biker's real life. Mm-hmm. And Pump Up the Base, especially, it gets heavily into pedaling technique. And I realized,
you should tell me about that. We've mentioned pedaling technique a couple of times, or you have, and I think I know what you're talking about. And I think I can actually remember a moment in which I saw quite a significant increase in power for the same heart rate when I started using your technique. So maybe you could describe that for me.
Well, I don't want to describe all of them because, you know, I want to sell them. But I see that, you know, we have the body we have. This is, you're a great climber. I'm not. Right on. I mean, we spend so much freaking time pedaling as bike riders. Mm-hmm. Like, well, let's just pay attention, you know? And so the approach that I have, and Lester got me started on it and I fleshed it out, it's all about making the power phase as long as possible. We don't pull up. We don't scrape mud. None of that anymore. We basically use the big muscles. And I'll give you the best drill ever. For free is this. It's simple. As your pedal approaches the top of the stroke, drop your heel. Like, start dropping it right past 9 o'clock and try to start pushing forward by 12 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Like, and there's more to it, but that's the basics. And if you can do that, you make your power phase longer. You kind of minimize the opposite dead phase. And as you know, because I think you spend time on flat pedals, you can learn this technique with flat pedals. Like, it's pedal agnostic.
Right.
And I think that's when you started showing your massive benefit. It's when you learn to ride flats. It's just like learning how to downhill on flats. Like if you learn how to ride downhill on flats, your feet are being taught exactly what to do, right? Yeah. So if you learn how to pedal with flats, you're teaching your feet exactly what to do. And my thought is, all right, like more and more of my clients never go back to clips. They never do. But when you do clip in, you have a neuromuscular pattern. And that way your feet already know what to do. It's handled and you can make more power. And yeah, so we see massive amounts of, I think you said 8%.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I just looked it up and it was 8% power after learning. I mean, it took me a while to kind of figure it out. It didn't happen overnight from you telling me. It's not that simple a trick. So
right.
Yeah, you need to go do the class and have Lee show you and then practice it some. But yeah, so an 8% power increase at threshold, which is huge. That's like the difference between, I mean, this is going back a couple of years now, 2012, I think it was. But
yeah,
I mean, certainly now, if you put 8% on my power at threshold, I probably could ride my bike for a living. But
it's pretty, that's huge. And you came in really fit. And I saw the same exact number from another professional rider here in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
Same drills, same classes. And he spent the winter on flat pedals and in the spring he showed 8%. And that's you guys are both considered to be pretty elite. Like I'm not elite. And so my numbers, like I said, over the past few years are up 50% mm-hmm. plus.
It's incredible.
It's awesome. And you know, the bigger thing is, it's like this, like I'm not miserable climbing anymore. Like I got to the point where I was just like, I was a downhill. I didn't pay attention to climbing. I would do it, but I didn't like it. But now, I mean, I'm not as fast as some people, but at least I'm competent, you know, and it feels good.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes riding way more fun. And I suck less. That's like, I'm on the never ending quest, Chris, to suck less.
Yeah, I think I am too. The flat pedals, though, have definitely been instrumental, I think, in my progress. Some really good things. Everyone thought I'm nuts. I was nuts. And I think they still think I'm nuts when I turn up for a ride around with flat pedals. But
that's awesome.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, it's good for a number of reasons. It just gets me out. You develop bad habits with the clips. Like you stop putting your weight on the pedals and you don't even know it's happening. And it
right.
seems like having the weight on the pedals is instrumental to success.
I think so. And I think that the culture is coming around, but the cross-country people are still pretty dogmatic about it.
Yeah, like, I know that James Wilson's been campaigning for this quite strongly.
Yeah, he's heavy duty on that, you know. It's been a huge benefit. And it's funny, like I most of the time right now I clip in because I just like it. And mm-hmm. I hold out hope that I can go race some enduros. So when I do, I'll be clipped in. But if I'm on the road or the trainer, I'm almost always on flats.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I ride the pump track on flats and I jump sometimes in flats. But my road bike has flats on it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I still race with clipped in. But I mean, if you're just riding, then if you're not racing, then the flat pedals make a lot of sense. But apart from anything else, they're really comfortable. Like those super wide 510s and then like a really big platform to put your foot on is incredibly comfortable.
It just feels good, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the other thing. We are supposed to do this for fun, most of us. And I like the feeling. And if I'm on the trainer or the road, and I'm not doing something specifically horrifying where I have to clip in, I want to feel decent. So I run flats. And my favorite setup right now is I have a pair of the new Saint flat pedal, which is fantastic. And it'll last for 50 years. And I have a pair of Keen sandals.
Oh, wow.
And I live at the top of I live at 6,700 feet. And I ride up this hill all the damn time, 17% grade for 2 miles with sandals. And it feels great. Love it.
That's awesome.
I love it.
So my final question for you was, what makes a great coach? What have you strived for in yourself personally to become a better coach?
Yeah, that's a good one, man. I'd like to think that I'm a pretty good coach. I think
you
I'm
are an excellent coach, I think.
Well, thank you. People say, and I work with people who have seen the other guys, and they come to me, but I'm not aware of people going the other direction so much. So I feel like I provide a good product. I mean, that's complicated. I think a good coach needs to be a good enough rider to demonstrate the techniques that they're showing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's important. I don't have to go huck off a 50-foot cliff, but I could show you perfect technique on a 10-foot cliff. It's applicable, right?
Mm-hmm.
You got to be competent. I think you have to have a really deep understanding of the actual physical dynamics of what it takes to ride a bike well. And I don't think very many people have that. a way that they in a way that they can express. And thank goodness for my experience as a designer. You know, I design infographics, software systems, all kinds of things. Like I've been able to use that skill to dial in my teaching approach more and more over the years. It's getting simpler. And I use it, like if we're designing software, I'd use the same exact terms. Like we talk about scalability, we talk mm-hmm. about simplicity. Like it's just, I'll teach you something really basic that you'll get the first day and feel awesome about. Mm-hmm. And someday we'll just scale it up and make it crazier. So I think having that structure is super important. And I happen to have one. I happen to have designed one that I use and that my coaches that work for me use. I think that's a good one. I think that a good coach can reach anybody, you know, can reach any rider. I've been privy to some other sessions where the coach was a pro, right? And then he was a bartender, and he hates being a bartender, so he decided to be a coach, right? And that's fine. That's cool. But I've seen these guys, they have a really unique perspective on life because they've been a bike racer. And they spend time talking about how awesome they are and how they did it worlds and stuff. But I feel like if you can't associate and identify and reach your client, then you're useless. Does that make sense?
It does make a lot of sense, yeah.
And so I feel like one thing I have going for me, and maybe when I was a racer, I thought it was against me, but now I understand it's a power I have, is that I really am a normal dude athletically.
So you know what the client is going through, the guy in your class.
Oh my God, I know what you're going through. And I understand too, like Christopher Kelly might be kind of a type A guy. I'm that guy too. I understand where you're coming from, brother. Mm. I get it. And I've been there, and I have a family. And I have injuries, and I have fear that I've worked through. And I've also have been able to achieve some pretty cool things on a bike and compete at a high level too. Mm-hmm. So like, if you're a pro, I think I can help you understand and trust me to help you get better. And if you're a total beginner and you're coming in totally nervous, I think I can really reach you and come to where you need me. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah.
And I think that's a big, big part. It's not about me, Chris. Like, if you hire me to teach you, right, I will understand to you the best I can, and I'll give you everything. I'll do everything I can to help you get better. It has nothing to do with me. Mm-hmm. I'm just a vessel. I'm a conduit for this thing.
Yeah, it comes that your humility comes across in this interview, I think, as well as it does in the classes, and it's extremely compelling. It's a really nice thing.
Thanks, man.
The problem is, though, there's not many people like you, is there? Like, if I live not in Colorado, then I'm kind of in trouble, right? Who else is doing this kind of stuff that is comparable?
There are other coaches out there, and if you find a coach who meets your needs, then I say go for it. That's awesome. What we're doing over here at Lee Likes Bikes is we're starting to scale up, so we have a small team of coaches now. There are four of us total. There's me. There's Kevin Stifler. He's here in Colorado, but he travels. There's Andy Somerville. He's in Southern California. He's brilliant too. And there's Judd Zimmerman, who's also exceptional, and he is in Utah. So I'm always looking for the right people. I'm looking for a very special person, Chris, mm-hmm. to add to the team. I'm always looking for that. And then we're starting to scale out and teach elsewhere. So like, for example, this fall, I can pull up on my site right now. Da-da-da, internet's never fast enough, is it? In the next month or so, I'll be in Southern California, Peoria, Illinois, and Northern California. And Kevin will be teaching in New York State. So we're starting to get around. If any of your listeners wants us to come out, what I'll do is we basically set up a day. That's how I got to Peoria last month. A client hired me for the day, and then I tried to fill some other days, and they sold out. And it turns out there's an amazing community there. So I'm going back. So we can go pretty much anywhere. Just reach out to us, and we can organize a trip around it.
Oh, that's good. That's scaled quite a lot, actually. I didn't know that. I mean, I know that's the way to do it. You know, when you get someone that's really good at something, then you need to have them training other people to do what you do.
Totally. And that's and I'm just being careful with it. And you know what I'm doing now, too, is I have two beta customers right now. I'm starting a remote coaching program because I know that not everybody can come and meet me, right? So, and if someone wants to come to the site and email me, we can get started on it now. But basically what we do is I give you drills, and then you do them, and you send me video, And then I give you feedback and we kind of go back and forth, you know?
Oh, wow. That's a really interesting idea.
So that's kind of the future for me, is to take all the coaching experience I have and the systems I have and basically make them available to anybody anywhere in the world. And that's my next big mission. And like I said, I've started already. So if someone wants to get after it, like at some point when you come to my site, leelikespikes.com, there will be a tab for remote coaching. But right now you can just email me at leelikespikes.com if you want to do it. And we can start to work it out.
Brilliant. That sounds excellent. One final question. So the medical doctor that we're partnered with, Jamie Bush, has also done some coaching with you. Yeah. What was she like? Is she any good?
She's a heck of an athlete, man.
But yeah, not just, I know she goes fast up the hill, but what do you think about down? Do you think, what do you think she should be working on?
She came in with good, and of course she rides with Jeff Kendall Weed, who's amazing.
Yeah, he's just ninja. He's ridiculous.
Yeah, that guy is full ninja. I've admired him for years. She came in with like the normal bad habits that you would have, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that she's really sharp and she knows her body. And so for her, it's just a matter of working on that position that we've been doing, being mm-hmm. more in the middle of the bike and then learning to be more active and more decisive. Mm-hmm. Like most riders are kind of passive and they let things happen. We want you. It's like a Tony Robbins tape. I want you to do things. I want you to be decisive, and I want her to do the same thing. Like if her bike is going to do something, I don't want her to wait for it to do it. I want her to make it do it. Put her in charge.
Brilliant. I'm sure she'll get to hear this and she'll take that on.
Nice.
So yeah, thank you so much for your time today, Lee. I really
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It. This has been great. And so Lee Likes Bikes is the place to find you if you want to book some clinics and
yes, sir.
And you can find your programs there too and the books. Is that the best place to buy the book now?
Yeah, I appreciate you buying it there because I make a little bit more money on it. But if you want to buy the books on Amazon or anywhere in the world, wherever you are, go for it. It's awesome.
Brilliant. Okay. Thanks, then, Lee.
You're very welcome, sir. Have a good day. Thanks.